before I had a chance to utter something that was bound to mortify me, one of the waiters recognized me and right away took me to what had been our table 3 nights earlier. It occurred to me that, despite Michel's denial, I was not the first young man to have walked into the brasserie looking slightly awkward, and whom the help had been trained to spot as yet another of his guests. I was a touch miffed, but decided not to nurse a grudge or let the feeling fester. Perhaps I was making it all up. And maybe I was, because when I was shown to his table not 5 steps away from the door, there he was, already seated, nursing an aperitif. In my confused state, I'd failed to notice he'd been staring at me all along. We hugged, and then, unable to control myself, I told him, "I've spent the most wonderful day of the year." "Why?" he asked. "I still haven't figured out why," I said, "but it may have something to do with last night."
"Last night and this morning for me," he smiled. I liked that he wasn't reluctant to show he had appreciated our hasty little morning sequel. I liked his mood, his smile, liked everything. A moment of silence, and I couldn't hold back. "You're wonderful. I've been meaning to tell you, you're just wonderful." As soon as I unfolded my napkin, it hit me. I had lost my appetite. "I'm not at all hungry," I said.
"Now you're the one who is wonderful."
"Why?"
"Because I'm not hungry either. I wasn't going to say it. Let's just go home. Maybe a snack? A single malt? A single malt with nuts and salted things?"
"Definitely nuts and salted things."
He turned to the head waiter. "Apologies to the chef, but we've changed our mind. A demain." When we reached his home, we ditched the idea of a drink or a snack. We took off our clothes, left them on the floor, skipped the shower, and went straight to bed. Thursday that week, we met again at 9 at the same restaurant. Friday for lunch, and then for dinner as well. After breakfast that Saturday, he said he was going to drive to the country and that I was welcome to join him. "If I was free," he added with that guarded and typically unassuming, ironic lilt in his voice, meant to show he was perfectly prepared to accept I had a life outside of our meetings and that he was never going to ask why, where, when, or with whom. But having spoken, he probably felt he might as well go all the way. We could come back on Sunday evening just in time for our 1 week anniversary concert. I couldn't tell what was making him slightly uneasy, the invitation to spend the weekend with him, or the open admission that the two of us already had an anniversary to celebrate. To tidy things with his usual reserve, he quickly added that if I wished to join him, he could drop me at my flat, wait in the car while I packed a few warm things. It gets cold at night, and we'd be off. "Where to?" I asked, which was my hasty way of saying, "Of course I'll come." "I have a home about an hour away from the city." I joked and said I felt like Cinderella.
"How so?"
"When does the clock strike midnight? When does the honeymoon end?" I asked.
"It ends when it ends."
"Is there an expiration date?"
"The manufacturers haven't determined an expiration yet.
So we're on our own. And besides, this is different," he said.
"Don't you say this to everyone?"
"I do, and I have, but you and I have something very special. And for me, totally unusual. If you'll let me, I hope to prove it to you this weekend."
"A likely story," I said.
We both laughed.
"The irony is that I may even succeed in proving it. And then where will we be?"
He looked at me.
"And that, if you care to know, is the part that scares me more than a little."
I could have asked him to elaborate, but once again, felt that this could lead into territory neither of us wished to enter.
The home, when we finally reached it more than an hour later, wasn't Brideshead, but it wasn't Howard's End either. I grew up here, he said. It's big, it's old, and it's always, always cold. Even the bikes are old and rickety, nothing like yours. There's a lake down beyond the wood, and I like it there. It's where I recharge. I'll show you around later. Plus, there's an old Steinway.
Great! But is it tuned?
He looked slightly embarrassed. I had it tuned.
When, though?
Yesterday. For no reason, I suppose.
For no reason.
We both smiled. It was moments of sudden and radiant intimacy like these that made me want to shout, "It's been years since I've been like this with anyone." I put my arm around his shoulder. "So you knew I'd come." "Not knew. Hoped." He showed me around the house, then walked me to the large parlor. We didn't exactly step inside, but stood at the doorway like two characters looking on as Velázquez paints his two monarchs. The ageless wooden floor around the large Persian rugs was gleaming gold and was clearly the beneficiary of years of buffing. One could smell the wax polish. "I'll always remember," said Michel, "how it used to get so lonely in the fall at the start of each school year when we'd come to spend weekends here. Those days felt like never-ending rainy Sundays that start at 9 in the morning and never let up until winter comes. And we'd be driving back to Paris at 4, feeling sapped and silent in the car. My parents hated each other, but never said it. The only thing that stirred any joy, and it was more relief than joy, was Sunday evening when we'd unlock the door to our flat in town, turn on one light after the other, until life seemed to pick up its pace with the promise of a concert, which was when my whole world rose from its induced stupor called schoolwork, called dinner, called mother, called silence and loneliness, and worst of all, perpetual boyhood. I wouldn't wish my childhood or adolescence in this house on anyone. Life was like a waiting room at a doctor's office, and my turn never came. He saw me smile. All I ever did here was homework and masturbate. I think there isn't a room in this whole mansion where I didn't do homework. And masturbate. It made us both laugh. We were having a simple, almost frugal lunch in the dining room. From what I inferred, he normally drove here late on Saturday mornings and would leave by Sunday afternoon. Habit, he explained. The L-shaped house was large, and its facade was late 18th century Palladian, very plain and unassuming, almost bland in its predictable symmetries, which probably explained its restrained yet welcoming grace. And then came the mysterious right-angle wing, which created an intimate space that yielded a well-tended semi-enclosed Italian garden. The mansard roof with its dormer windows immediately made me think of a cold room up there where the lonely boy, who would one day become my lover, sat at his desk and dutifully did his homework while nursing all manner of lurid thoughts. I felt for the boy. His mother always made him bring his homework along, so there was little else to do here, much less to enjoy, he said. I asked him about his school days. He attended the Lycée J. I hated it, he said, but my father would sometimes drop by and arrange to take me out for a few hours. It was to be our secret. He too had studied there, so walking with him around the neighborhood on a weekday and going in and out of stores was like sliding into a buoyant grown-up world I was not entitled to. While I'm sure that slipping into my little world was his way of reliving his years as a lycéen, only to thank his lucky stars for keeping them forever locked behind him. He wouldn't be surprised, he said, if I hated school. When one afternoon I showed him into my empty classroom, he was baffled to see that not a thing had changed since the days before the war. The overpowering smell of the old wooden desks still lingered in the room, he said, and that dusky slant of failing afternoon light that could smother every indecent thought in a boy's mind still swept over the dust on the dark brown furniture in my dark brown smelly classroom of Lycée J. Do you miss him?
Miss him? Not really.
Maybe because, unlike my mother who died 8 years ago, he never really died for me. He's just absent. Sometimes it's almost as though he might change his mind and slip in through a back door somewhere. Which is why I never really mourned him. He's still around, just elsewhere. He thought for a moment. I've kept most of his things, his neckties especially, his rifles, golf clubs, even his old wooden tennis rackets. I used to think I was keeping them as mementos, the way I'd sealed two of his sweaters in plastic bags so they might retain his scent. It's not death I refuse, but extinction. I'll never use his warped wooden racket, still strung with old catgut. The main reason I lament not being closer to my son now that he has children is not because I know I would have made an excellent grandfather, but because I wish he had met my father and loved him as I did, so that now my son and I could sit together on November days like here today and remember him. There is no one to remember my father with. Could this be my role? I asked, completely naively. He did not respond. But I should tell you that if there is one thing I regret now, almost 30 years later, it's that he never met you. Today this weighs on me as if a link is missing in my life. I don't know why. Perhaps this is why I wanted to bring you here this weekend. I was going to ask whether it wasn't perhaps too soon to meet his parents, and the thought brought a smile to my face, but I decided not to say anything, not because my ironic comment wouldn't sit well at that moment, but because a voice told me that it wasn't too soon. Indeed, it was about time I met, or rather heard, about his parents. You're scaring me a bit, I said, because it means that I'll never pass muster unless your father approves, and since he'll never know me, you'll never approve? Wrong. I know he'd approve. That's not it. I think it would have made him happy to know I've been happy this whole week. He stopped a moment. Or is this too much pressure for those of your generation? I shook my head and smiled, meaning, you're so off the mark about me and my generation. I've been blabbering on so much about my father that I'm sure you must think I have a father fixation. I hardly think of him, but I do dream of him. They are usually very sweet and soothing dreams. So here's a funny thing. He even knows about you. It was he who, in a dream, steered me away from visiting piano bars to go directly to the conservatory instead. Clearly, my subconscious speaks through him. Would you have sought me out anyway? Probably not. What a waste that would have been. Would you have come to this Sunday's concert? You already asked me this, but you never answered. I know. He nodded, meaning my point exactly. After lunch, he asked if I wanted to try the piano. I sat down, played a few quick chords to test it, assumed a very grave air, and then started to play Chopsticks. He laughed. Before I knew what possessed me, I started to improvise on Chopsticks until I stopped and played a Chaconne composed recently in the old style. I played it beautifully because I was playing it for him, because it suited autumn, because it spoke to the old house, to the boy in him still, and to the years between us I was hoping to erase. When I stopped, I asked him to tell me exactly what he had been doing when he was my age. probably working in my father's law firm, being completely miserable because I hated it, and also because there was no one, just no one special in my life except for the occasionals. Then from nowhere, he asked when was the last time I'd had sex. Promise not to laugh. No. Last November. But that's a year ago! And even then, but I didn't finish the sentence. Well, the last time I brought someone to this house, I was probably your age, and he spent one night here and I never saw him again. He stopped short of finishing what he was about to say. He must have immediately figured what had just crossed my mind, that when he invited his lover here, I wasn't born yet. Then to change the subject, he added, I'm sure my father would have loved the piece you played. Why did your father stop playing? I'll never know. He played for me only once. I must have been 15 or 16. He told me it was a very difficult piece. By then, he had given up entirely on my musical aptitude. He sat at this very piano one day when Mother was away in Paris, and there it was. A short piece played, in my opinion, magnificently, La Chapelle de Guillaume Tell by Liszt. I knew right away, without a doubt, that my father was indeed a great pianist. I had seen many pictures of him in Tell sitting at a piano or standing after bowing to an audience, but I had never really come face to face with his life as a pianist. It was a closed door. A question I'll never be able to answer is why he stopped playing or why he never discussed it. Even when I told him once that I thought I'd heard him playing at night and that the music had drifted to my bedroom from a distant wing of the house, he denied it. It must have been a record, he said. After he was done playing the Liszt that one time, he simply asked, Did you like it? I didn't know what to say. All I muttered was, I'm so proud of you. He never expected me to say such a thing. He nodded a few times, but I could tell he was moved. Then he closed the piano and never played for me again. Puzzling. But he wasn't a closed man at all. He liked to talk about women, especially when I was in my mid to late teens after one of those concerts in the church. He would speak about music, but then sometimes he'd drift and end up talking about love. About the women he'd known in his younger days, and he'd speak about this intangible thing called pleasure, which no one ever really knows how to talk about, and which explains why I learned more about both pleasure and desire from him while we were walking back home from a concert than from those who were meant to help me discover what they were. He was a man who cultivated pleasure, though I doubt it was with my mother. He said so himself one day when he told me that it was far better to pay for a good half hour with a woman you might never see again than to spend time with one who leaves you more lonely after you've had a few minutes flouncing between her legs. He spoke that way. He was funny. One day after our Sunday concert, he said that if I wanted, he knew of a place where a woman could easily teach me what adults did together. I was curious and scared, but he told me where, whom to ask for, and gave me money for good measure. A week later, we were back to our Sunday evenings together and laughing on the way. So it happened, was all he asked. It happened, I replied. It brought us closer still. A few weeks later, I found a different kind of pleasure that he most likely knew nothing about. In retrospect, I regret never having told him about it. But in those days, he did not finish his sentence. Did I want to go for a stroll? He asked. I said yes. Michel said he used to have a dog, and they would go for long walks together, returning after dark. But since the dog had died, he never wanted another. He suffered a lot before dying, so I put him to sleep. but I won't ever go through such a loss again. I did not ask, but that I didn't ask must surely have warned him I'd pondered the question. Soon we approached the wood. He said he would show me the lake. It reminds me of Corot. It's always early evening and perpetually sunless here. Corot always has a dab of red on the boatman's bonnet in his paintings, like a sprig of mirth on gloomy November fields where there's never any snow. Reminds me of my mother, always on the verge of tears, but never a sob. This landscape makes me happy, perhaps because I can feel it's gloomier than I am. When we reach the lake, "Is this where you recharge?" I asked.
"The very place."
He knew I was ribbing him. We were going to sit on the grass, but it was damp, so we loitered by the shore a bit, then turned back. "I don't know how to tell you this, but there is a reason why I asked you here."
"You mean it has nothing to do with my looks or my youth or the sheer brilliance of my intellect, to say nothing of my ripped body?"
He embraced me and kissed me longingly on the mouth. "It definitely has to do with you. But I promise that what's in store will surprise you." It was starting to get cloudy.
"It really is Corot country, isn't it? Mournful as ever.
But it puts me in a good mood." "Or maybe that's because you're here," he said.
"Clearly because I'm here." He knew I was ribbing him again. "Or maybe because I'm happy too."
"Are you really?"
"I'm trying to hide it. Can't you tell?"
He put his arm around me, then kissed me on the cheek.
"Perhaps we should head back. A little Calvados wouldn't hurt." On the way back, he said it was my turn to talk about my family. He was probably trying to show he wasn't going to do all the talking about parents and was giving me equal time to talk about mine. "But there was so little to say," I said. "Both my parents were amateur musicians, so I was the culmination of their dreams. My father, a university professor, was my first piano teacher, but soon realized when I was 8 or so that my capacities surpassed his. The three of us were exceptionally close. They never disagreed with me, and I could do no wrong in their eyes. I was a quiet child, and by the time I was 18 or so, it was clear that my inclinations ran in all ways. I said nothing at first, but I am forever grateful that my father made it easy for us to speak about matters most parents are reluctant to even hint at. After I went to college, they separated. I think that unbeknownst to them, I was the bond that held them together, whereas they'd always had different interests, led different lives, and had very different friends. Then one day my mother ran into someone she'd known years before my father and decided to move to Milan with him. My father had altogether given up on meeting a partner, but a few years later, he met someone on a train of all places, and they now have a child whose godfather and half-brother I am. All told, everyone is quite happy."
"Do they know about me?" he asked.
"They do. I told him on Thursday when he called. Miranda also knows."
"Do they know I'm much older than you?"
"They do. My father, incidentally, is twice her age."
He paused a moment and was silent.
"Why did you tell them about me?"
"Because it matters, that's why. And don't ask me if it does."
We stopped walking. He scraped his shoes against a fallen branch, tore a shoot and cleaned the rest of the shoe with it, then looked at me.
"You could just be the dearest person I've ever known. Which also means you could hurt me, devastate me, actually.
Do people speak like this in your generation?"
"Enough with my generation and stop saying things like this. This kind of talk upsets me."
"I won't say another word then."
"Do people you know ever use the big word. I could feel it coming. Please hold me. Just hold me. He put his arms around me and held me tightly. We resumed walking in silence, arm in arm, until it was my turn to scrape my shoe.
Koro country, I cursed.
It made the two of us laugh. Back in the house.
I want to show you the kitchen. It hasn't changed in eons.
We walked into a large kitchen that was clearly never meant to be a place where the owners might sit to have coffee or eggs. Pots and pans of all makes were hanging on the walls, but not in that faux, fashionably cluttered, chic French country style found in magazines and home decor catalogs. It was ancient and dysfunctional in parts, and no one was going to hide it. As I surveyed the room, I thought that it probably had electric wiring and gas and water pipes going back many decades, if not generations, which probably needed to be torn out and replaced. We left the kitchen and headed to the parlor, where he opened a tiny antique wooden cabinet, found a bottle, and took out two snifters, which he held in one hand with his fingers thrust between their stems. I liked how he did this. I'm going to show you something I believe no one has ever seen. It came into my father's hands not long after the Germans left our house. When I was in my very late 20s and a few days before my father fell into a coma, he knew his time had come, and no one was stupid enough to try to tell him otherwise. He asked me, when we were alone together, to unlock this tiny cabinet and to take out a large leather envelope. My father said he was younger than I was at the time when what was in the envelope came into his possession. What is it? I asked, holding the envelope. Open it. I expected some sort of deed, will, or certificate, or a compromising set of photos. Instead, when I opened the leather folio, I found a musical score on 8 double-sided sheets of onion paper. The staffs were drawn by the unsteady hand of someone who obviously didn't own a ruler. On the front was written, From Leon to Adrian, January 18, 1944. Adrian, my father, never explained. All he said was, do not destroy it, do not give it away to some archive or library, just pass it on to someone who'll know exactly what to do with it. It broke my heart because, from the look on his face as he spoke these words, I could tell he knew there was no one else in his life or in my life to give this to. I also think he knew, just knew, about me. That is. And the strange thing, as he looked at me with that deep, searching stare of those who know they are about to die, was that everything between us, every moment of love, every disappointment, every misunderstanding, every coded glance, had all but dissolved. Find someone, he said. Of course, as soon as I looked at the score, I was completely at a loss. Beyond the few years I'd spent playing the piano, I knew nothing about classical music, and he, on his part, never pushed me. So I never bothered with this score. There was another reason why I was truly perplexed when I took a look at it. I was born 20 years after the date on the score, and yet here was someone I'd never met, much less heard of, who bore my middle name, Leon. I asked my father who this man was, but he gave me a blank look, made a dismissive gesture with his hand, then said it would take too long, adding he was tired and that he preferred not to say, not to think. You're making me remember, and I don't want to remember, he said. I didn't know whether it was the morphine clouding his mind or whether he was resorting to his go-to phrase, I'd rather not say, when trying to avoid a delicate subject, especially when he wanted you to know that if he uttered another word, it would open up Pandora's box.
Had I kept asking, I would have received that curt, impassive hand motion of his again, which is how he dealt with beggars he had no patience with. I'd planned to ask him again anyway, but the score slipped from my mind and I needed to care for him as his condition kept worsening. In retrospect now, I almost think that what had kept him alive during his sickness was the need to find the chance to hand me the score without my mother's knowledge. Months after he died, I asked around and learned that not a soul on my mother's or my father's side of the family was called Leon. Finally, I asked my mother, who was Leon? She looked at me with a bewildered and amused look on her face. You, of course. Had there been another Leon, I asked? No one. Leon had been my father's idea. They had argued about names. She wanted Michel after my father's grandfather, who had bequeathed us his property. My father insisted on Leon. She won, of course. Leon as a second name was a concession. No one ever called me that. Only then did it dawn on me that my mother couldn't have known anything about the existence of Leon or of the score. Had she even seen the score, she would have asked who Leon was and wouldn't have let go of the matter until she'd gotten to the bottom of it. That's the way Mother was, intrusive and implacable once she set her mind on something. She insisted I become a lawyer, and there was no gainsaying her. As it turned out, and after I'd made some inquiries among the staff following the death of my father, one of the older servants did recall a certain Leon. Leon le Juif. Leon the Jew, they called him in the household, starting from my grandfather, who hated Jews, down to the cook and the chambermaids. But, in the words of the same old cook, that was a very long time ago, before your parents even knew each other. I could tell it was going to be like pulling teeth to get more out of our cook, so I let the matter slide, figuring I'd ask him at some other time and not give him the impression I was grilling him for answers. I asked him about the Germans who occupied our home, knowing that speaking about those days might lead us back to Leon, but all he said was that the Germans were de vrais gentlemen, who tipped well and treated my family with exceptional respect. Not like that old Jew, he said, recalling I had asked about Leon. He was the last in our family to have known Leon, but after my father died, he retired and moved back to the north, where he too disappeared. So the trail went cold. When my mother died, I decided to sort through the family papers, but I found nothing about the Jew. The one thing I failed to grasp was why my father had kept the score under lock and key, and why I had ended up with Leon's name. What had happened to my namesake? I had hoped to find a diary or a school record of my father's early years, but my father had never kept a diary. I did find diplomas and certificates and numberless musical scores among his papers, some on paper so brittle and with such high acidic content that they crumbled as soon as you touched them. Strange to say, though, I never once saw him leaf through those scores. Occasionally, when he'd overhear pianists on the radio, he would criticize their playing, always saying, "He might as well be typing on a Remington." Or about another world-famous pianist, a great pianist, but an appalling musician. I have no sense of how turning to law changed him, or for that matter, why he abandoned his career as a musician. Or to put it more bluntly, I never got to know who was the man behind the man I thought my father was. I knew the lawyer only, and had never even seen or met or lived with the pianist. And it kills me still today not to have known and spoken to the pianist. The person I knew was his second self. I suspect we have first selves and second selves and perhaps third, fourth, and fifth selves and many more in between. Whom am I speaking to now? I asked, seizing his drift. Second, third, or first self? Second, I think. Age, my friend.
but a part of me would die to have you speak to my younger self, to have had you here in this house when I was your age. The irony is that with you, I feel your age, not mine. I am sure there'll be a price to pay for this.
You're such a pessimist.
Maybe, but my younger self bungled and sped through so many things. An older self is more frugal, more cautious, and therefore more reluctant, or more desperate, to rush into things he already fears he might never find again. But you have me here and now.
Yes.
But for how long? I did not answer. I was trying to avoid touching on the future, but as a result must have sounded more fatuous than he would have wished. This, today, like yesterday, he said, like Thursday, like Wednesday, has been a gift. I could so easily never have found you, or never run into you again. I didn't know what to say, so I smiled. With that, he poured each of us a second glass of Calvados. I hope you like this. I nodded, as I'd done the first time with the single malts. Fate, if it exists at all, he said, has strange ways of teasing us with patterns that may not be patterns at all, but that hint at a vestigial meaning still being worked out. My father, your father, the piano, always the piano. And then you, like my son, but not like my son. And this Jewish thread running through both our lives. All of it reminds me that our lives are nothing more than excavation digs. That there are always tiers deeper than we thought. Or maybe it's nothing. Just nothing. In any case, I'll leave you with the score. I'm going to see what they're preparing for dinner tonight. Meanwhile, let me know what you think. Remember, you are one of the very, very few who have ever seen it. He shut the door very quietly, as if to show that what I was about to do required great concentration, and that the last thing he wanted was to disturb me. I liked being alone in this room. It felt intimate despite its large size. I even liked the smell of the old thick curtains behind me, like the aged mahogany paneling on the wall and the dark red rug, even like my sunken, flaking old leather armchair and the excellent Calvados. Everything felt aged, passed on, and set in place centuries ago for centuries to come. Wars and revolutions could not undo this because stubborn legacy and longevity seemed permanently inscribed everywhere in this mansion, down to the delicate snifter I was holding in my hand. Michel had grown up here, been sheltered here, been stifled here. I wondered if he'd used this very armchair while scanning for erotic images in magazines as a teenager. What did he expect me to do with the score? Tell him it was good or bad? Say the Jew was a genius? Or maybe an idiot? Or was he looking for the man his father was before becoming a father, and hoping I'd help dig him out from this rubble of musical notations? I began leafing through the score, and the more I stared at its second page, the more I began to question why the staff lines were drawn in so unsteady a hand. There was only one explanation for this. There was no staved stationery available when this was written. Besides, Leon must have assumed that Adrian would immediately recognize the notes, or at least know what to do with them. But then I began to notice something else. The score had no perceptible beginning, which meant either that the score was incomplete or that it was composed at the very peak of the modernist era. And yet, how unoriginal was that, I thought, irony bringing a smirk to my face. I looked at the last page of the score, not expecting to find a clear ending to the piece either, and indeed there was nothing but a long trill leading absolutely nowhere. How predictable, I thought, and how dull. The no-ending ending. Modernism at its foulest. Part of me didn't have the heart to tell Michel any of this. I didn't want to tell him that the score so faithfully coddled by his father and for so long was worth less than the Cartier leather folder where it had slumbered in a locked cabinet. Better to have left it sleeping. Then as I kept leafing through the first three pages, I became aware of something that truly made my heart sink. I'd seen these notes before. Dear God, I'd even played them 5 years earlier in Naples. But not quite in this order. It took no time to recognize the notes. The poor fellow had been copying Mozart. How banal! And then worse yet, I couldn't believe it. A few bars later, and not so subtly, I thought I recognized wisps of something everyone knew, the recognizable lilting rondo lifted from Beethoven's Waldstein Sonata. Our dear Leon was stealing left and right. I looked at the pale sepia ink. Either the ink had faded over the years or the writer was using diluted ink. It looked so desperately and hastily scribbled down that I imagined Leon mailing it from the Gare du Nord, just as the train was inching its way out to who knows where he was headed in 1944. Did its owner have a sense of humor, I thought, as he pilfered notes left and right? Was he intelligent or a fool? Could one tell anything by the handwriting? And how old could Leon have been? A young prankster in his mid-twenties like Michel at the time? Or was he even younger? As I was trying to guess who and what Leon was, it suddenly hit me that there was a reason why I recognized the first series of notes. They were composed, or partially composed by Mozart, but this was no sonata. No prelude, no fantasy or fugue. This was a cadenza to Mozart's D minor piano concerto, which was why I had recognized the theme. But he was not copying Mozart, he was quoting from Beethoven's own cadenza to Mozart's concerto, which had also inspired Leon to echo a few bars from the Waldstein sonata. Leon was having fun. All he'd done was to compose the parts that the pianist Adrian was probably meant to improvise at the end of the first movement, that glorious moment when the orchestra stops and lets the pianist play at will, which is where imagination, boldness, love, freedom, prowess, talent, and a profound understanding of what lies at the very heart of Mozart's concerto can finally shout their love of music and invention in a cadenza. The composer of the cadenza had divined what Mozart hadn't finished composing and what Mozart had left open-ended for others to finish for him, even if they composed it in an entirely different age when music had altogether changed. What one needed to enter into the mystery of Mozart's composition was not to wear Mozart's shoes or walk in his gait or echo his idiom, his voice, his pulse, his style even. What one needed was to reinvent him in ways he himself would never have imagined, to build where Mozart had stopped building, but to build what Mozart would still recognize as irreducibly his and only his. When Michel returned, I couldn't wait to tell him about the score. "This is not a sonata, it's a cadenza," I began. "Chicken or beef?" he interrupted. Our supper and well-being tonight trumped everything else. I loved it when he did this. "Are we on an airplane?" I asked. "We might serve vegan food as well," he continued, parodying an Air France stewardess. "And I have a fabulous red." He stopped a moment. "You were saying?" "Not a sonata, but a cadenza." "A cadenza! Of course! I suspected it all along." He halted a second. "And what's a cadenza?" I laughed. "It's a brief 1 to 2 minute moment in a piano concerto when the soloist improvises upon a theme already explored in the concerto itself. Usually, the signal for the orchestra to come clamoring back in and close the movement is a trill
played by the pianist at the very end of his cadenza. I couldn't figure out what the trill was when I first saw it, but now it makes perfect sense. This cadenza, however, goes on and on. I don't know for how long yet, but it's obviously more than 5 to 6 minutes long.
So this was my father's big secret? 6 minutes of music and that's it?
I suppose.
Doesn't add up, does it?
I'm not sure yet. I have to study this. Leon keeps echoing the Waldstein.
The Waldstein! He repeated the word with a broad smile.
It took me a moment, and then, once again, I understood why he was smiling. Don't tell me you're twice my age and you've never heard the Waldstein Sonata.
I know it inside out.
Again the smile. You're fibbing, I know it, I can tell.
Of course I'm fibbing.
I stood up, went to the piano, and started playing the opening bars of the Waldstein. The Waldstein, of course, he said. Was he still joking?
Actually, I've heard it many times. I stopped playing and then moved to the rondo.
He said he knew it too.
Then sing it, I said. I'll do no such thing.
Sing it with me, I said. No.
I started singing the rondo, and after a bit of coaxing by staring at him from the piano, began hearing his tentative attempts at song. I played more slowly, and then asked him to sing louder till in the end we were singing in unison. He placed both hands on my shoulders. I thought it was a signal to stop, but then he said, "Don't stop." So I continued playing and singing.
"What a voice you have," he said. "If I could, I would kiss your voice."
"Keep singing," I said, so he kept singing. When I turned around at the end of our crooning, I noticed he had tears in his eyes. "Why?" I asked.
"I don't know why.
Maybe because I never ever sing. Or maybe it's just this, being with you. I want to sing."
"Don't you sing in the shower sometimes?"
"Not in ages."
I got up and with my left thumb wiped the tears from both his eyes. "I like that we sang," I said.
"I do too," he said.
"Did it make you sad?"
"Not at all. I was just moved, as though you'd pushed me out of myself. I like it when you do that, push me out of myself. Plus, I'm so shy that I tear up as easily as some people blush."
"You shy?"
"I don't think you're shy at all.
You wouldn't believe how shy.
You spoke to me out of nowhere, picked me up actually, in a church of all places, and then you took me out to dinner. Shy people don't do any of this." "The reason it happened that way is because I wasn't planning any of it, wasn't even thinking. It all came so easily. Maybe because you helped. Of course I wanted to ask you to come home with me that same night, but I didn't dare. So you left me stranded, all alone, with my backpack, my bicycle, and my helmet. Thanks."
"You didn't mind."
"I did mind. I was hurt.
And yet now you're here with me in this room."
He paused a moment. "Is this too much for you?
My generation again?"
We laughed. Getting back to Leon, I took up the score. "Let me explain to you how a cadenza works."
I riffled through his record collection, all jazz, but finally landed on a Mozart concerto. Then I located a very complex and expensive-looking music system sitting on an 18th-century coffee table. As I fiddled to see how it worked, I avoided looking at him so as not to give what I was about to ask any importance.
"Who told you to buy this?" I asked.
"Nobody told me. I told myself, okay?"
"Okay," I said.
He knew I liked his answer. "And I know how to work it myself. All you had to do was ask me." It took a few moments, and we began listening to Mozart's piano concerto.
I let him hear a bit of the first movement, then lifted the stylus and moved it forward to the part where I suspected the cadenza started. This cadenza was composed by Mozart himself. We listened to the cadenza until I pointed out the trill that signaled the return of the full orchestra. That was Murray Pariah playing. Very elegant, very clear, simply superb. The key to his cadenza is these few notes taken from the main theme. I'll sing them for you, and then you will too.
Absolutely not.
Don't be a baby.
No way.
I played the notes first, then began singing as I was playing them, and continued playing to show off a bit. Your turn now, I said while playing the notes again, and then turned my head toward him to signal it was his turn. He hesitated at first, but then did as he asked and began humming the notes. You have a good voice, I finally said. Then, because I felt inspired, I played the notes once more and told him to sing them again, saying, it would make me happy. And he did sing again until we sang together. Next week I will start taking piano lessons, he said. I want the piano to be part of my life again. Maybe I want to learn composition too. I couldn't tell whether he was humoring me. Would you let me be your teacher? I asked.
Of course I would. What a stupid question. The question is, oh, shush.
Then I told him to sit while I played Beethoven's and then Brahms cadenzas to Mozart's D minor concerto. Luminous, I said, as I began playing, feeling that I was playing the two perfectly. There are many others. One was even composed by Mozart's own son, I said. I played. He listened. And then, because I felt inspired, I played him my own improvised version on the spot. This can go on forever, if you wish. I so wish I could do this. And you will. I'd be better at the piano if I practiced earlier this morning, but someone had other plans for the day.
You didn't have to agree.
I wanted to. Then, out of the blue, could you play the notes you played for your student from Thailand? You mean this, I said, knowing exactly what he was referring to. What's interesting here is that after our friend Leon's cadenza quotes a few bars of the Waldstein Sonata, something far crazier happens.
What? He asked, almost overwhelmed by too many musical facts for one day. I looked at the score, and then, once again, just to make certain that I wasn't making any of it up,
it seems to me, and I'm not sure yet, that at some point after quoting the Waldstein, Leon dithers a while until he slips from the Beethoven to something that very possibly inspired another piece by Beethoven, something called the Kol Nidre.
Of course, he said, he was close to laughing. Kol Nidre is a Jewish prayer. You see, the Jewish theme is very veiled, but it's smuggled in there. And my hunch is that unless someone were musically trained, only a Jew who reads music would recognize that the centerpiece of this cadenza is not the Beethoven, but the Kol Nidre. Those few measures are repeated 7 times, so Leon knew exactly what he was doing.
Then, of course, he goes back to the Waldstein and to the trill that announces the return of the full orchestra. To let him know what I had in mind, I played the cadenza and then the Kol Nidre bit by bit for him.
What is the Kol Nidre?
It's an Aramaic prayer at the start of Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the Jewish calendar, and represents the recantation of all vows, all oaths, all curses, all obligations made to God. But the melody has charmed composers. My hunch is that Leon knew that your father would recognize it. It was like a coded message between them. But I know this tune, he suddenly said. Where did you hear it?
I don't know, I just don't know, but I know it.
Maybe from way, way back.
Michel thought for a moment, then, as though rousing himself, said, I think we should sit down for dinner.
But I needed to get the matter off my chest. There are 2 ways in which your father could have known this tune. Either Leon hummed or played it for him. Why, I have no idea, unless it was to prove that Jewish liturgy had beautiful music, Or your father attended a Yom Kippur service, which might suggest a closer bond between the two. The service on that day is not an occasion for tourists to come and watch how Jews celebrate the Day of Atonement. Michel thought for a moment, then said, "If you invited me, I'd come." I took his hand, held it, kissed it. During dinner, we discussed what we considered might have been the reason for the secret cadenza. An inside joke, a distillation of a work in progress, a challenge to the pianist. Maybe a gesture from one to the other, a salutation, in memory of a friendship that might have lapsed. Who knows? "So many things I haven't had time to examine yet," I said. "Unless the cadenza was thought up in dire circumstances and was a Jewish salvo composed from hell itself. Are we reading too much into this?" "Maybe. We have an amazing butcher in town, so the fillet is simply excellent. And our cook loves vegetables, asparagus, if she can still find it, which she cooks magnificently despite her allergies. I love Indian rice, so smell this," he said, delicately fanning the air over the rice in my direction. He knew he was teasing me. But then, I said, there was something missing. "Leon is Jewish, is hated by your grandparents, is most likely considered a bad influence on your father's career, and the servants think he's beneath them. France is already occupied, and soon the Germans will be living under this very roof, if they aren't already eating at this very table, which you told me they did. Leon cannot be in the same house unless he is hiding in the attic, which no one here would have tolerated. So how does the score fall into your father's hands?" I had brought it with me to the dining table. "Try this wine. We have 3 bottles left. We've let it breathe in the kitchen. Can you just focus, please?" "Yes, of course." "What do you think of the wine?" "It's stunning, but why are you constantly interrupting?" "Because I love seeing you focusing like this, and I love it when you get so serious. I still can't believe you're staying with me. I can't wait to have you in my bed. Can't wait." I sipped some more wine. Then he replenished my glass. As I was cutting the meat, I couldn't help adding, "We still need to figure out how the score ended up here. Who brought it and when? For a Jew to come here to deliver a score in 1944 seems absurd. In fact, how it got here might say everything about this score. It might even say more than the music itself." "This makes no sense. It's like suggesting that the way a famous poem got to the printers is more important than the poem itself." "In this case, it may be just so." Michel looked at me with bewilderment, as though he had never thought of things in this twisted manner. "Was it delivered by mail?" I asked. "By hand, or did Adrian pick it up himself? Was a third party involved? A friend, or a nurse in a hospital, or someone from the camps? This is 1944, and the Germans are still occupying France, so he could have fled or been captured. If he was in the camps, which camp was it? Was he in hiding? Did he survive?" I thought about it some more. "There are 2 things that might tell us a lot, and we're missing both. Why did the composer draw the staves himself, and why are the notes so crammed together like this?"
"Why would this be important?"
"Because my hunch is that perhaps these notes were not jotted down hastily at all." I riffled once again through the pages. "Notice, there's not a single scratch mark. Nothing was crossed out where the composer might have changed his mind while composing. These notes were being transcribed, and in a place where score paper was impossible to come by, where it was even difficult to find ordinary paper. The notes are so terribly crammed, as though he were afraid he would run out of paper." I raised the first sheet toward the candle standing in the middle of the dining table. "What are you doing?" he asked. "Looking for a watermark. A watermark might tell us a lot."
where the paper was manufactured, in which part of France, or elsewhere, if you follow my drift. Michel looked at me.
I follow your drift.
Unfortunately, there was no watermark on the paper. All I can deduce is that it was cheap onion paper. So the composer of the cadenza already knows these themes and transfers the notes in this compressed form. He wants your father to have this cadenza. This is all we know.
No, we know something more. My father gives up playing altogether and begins to study law. The world of music is entirely shut to him. I cannot believe that this has nothing to do with Leon, because one thing we do know, he kept this cadenza as though it were the most precious thing in his life. But then why keep it if he was never going to play it? Why lock it up all those years in this cabinet unless he promised to play it only in Leon's presence? Or unless he kept it so that someone else should materialize and play it? Someone like you, Elio. This flattered me, but I did not want to appear to have seized what he was implying. Do you think he meant to return it to Leon or to someone dear to Leon? Or did he simply not know what to do with it and didn't have the heart to be rid of it the way you continue to keep your father's tennis rackets? Perhaps the most important thing is to determine who Leon was. After dinner, using his computer, I typed in Adrian's full name and within seconds saw the years when he attended the conservatory. Even his picture appeared. Dapper and natty, I said, and handsome. I searched for the name of teachers before, during, and after those years. The records were desultory and scattered, but in not one was there a person called Leon. I looked for Jewish, German, or Slavic-sounding surnames, or any with L as a first initial. Nothing there either. I looked for students with the name Leon. Nothing. Either he had another name, or his name was removed from the school records, or he'd never been at the conservatory. There is no Leon, I finally said. So, here ends our bit of detective work. By then we were sitting very close together on the sofa. The light was dim, and we were drinking more Calvados. Perhaps your father studied with Alfred Cortot, but I doubt that Leon did. Why, do you think?
Cortot was anti-Semitic, and became even more so under the occupation. I believe the violinist Thibault, whom Cortot knew well, played for the Führer. Terrible times.
Any more thoughts on the matter? He asked.
Why do you ask? He shook his head ever so mildly. No reason.
I just love being like this with you, talking the way we do at night in this room, sitting on this sofa, glued together while you're fiddling with the computer. And outside, all over, it's just November. I love that you've taken such an interest.
I love it too, very much.
And yet you don't believe in fate.
I told you I don't think in those terms.
Then maybe when you get to be my age and the dearth of things life has to offer becomes more evident by the day, maybe then you can start noticing those tiny accidents that turn out to be miracles, and that can redefine our lives and cast an incandescent luster over things that, in the great scheme of things, could easily be meaningless. But this is not meaningless.
This, here tonight, is wonderful.
Yes, it is wonderful.
But he said it with a tone of nostalgic resignation, verging on melancholy, as though I were a dish he was watching being taken away before he had his fill. Is this what happens when one is close to twice someone's age? One starts losing people, long before they've started looking elsewhere.
We sat this way without saying anything. I gave him what I thought was a hug, but what he returned was a real, sad, famished hug, filled with sensual despair. "What's wrong?" I asked, still reluctant to hear what I already suspected was going to be his answer.
"Not a thing. But then this is what's so scary, if you see my drift, precisely because there's nothing wrong."
"Give me more Calvados." He was happy to oblige. He stood up, walked over to the small cabinet behind one of the speakers, and took out another bottle.
Much better quality.
He knew I had changed the subject. I was hoping that something would lift this sudden cloud between us, but nothing came, and neither he nor I attempted to dispel it, perhaps because neither was quite sure what lurked behind it. So he enlightened me about the Calvados and its history, and I listened and read the tiny hand scrawl on the bottle's label giving a history of the house that produced it, which was when he had a stroke of genius and used an expression that had become a catchphrase between the two of us. "I want to make you happy." I knew exactly what he meant. "So keep reading the label. I don't want you distracted. I don't even want you looking." He picked up the glass of Calvados and sipped from it. Then I felt it. Felt his mouth. Felt the slight tingling.
"I love what you're doing,"
I finally said, shutting my eyes, trying to put the bottle down somewhere until I decided to place it on the carpet at the foot of the sofa. I remembered the housemaid.
"Gone already.
Didn't you hear her car?" We spent Sunday in the house. As Michelle remembered, it always seemed to rain on Sundays, and the wood where we'd planned to take a long walk was growing darker and bleaker by the hour. Late that morning, I practiced for a couple of hours while he leafed through some papers from his office. But ours was mostly perfunctory activity, and in the end, we were both relieved when the other tactfully suggested that perhaps it might be good to head back to Paris before traffic got heavy with Parisians returning late from the weekend. As we neared the city, there was a slightly awkward moment when it became clear he was planning to drop me at my address first, and that he was doing so either because he didn't want me to feel pressured to head straight to his home, or because he suspected I had other plans before our evening concert, or, I thought, he needed some time alone. After all, he had a habit of coming back to Paris on Sundays, and who knows, perhaps this was what he'd done for years and didn't want it changed. When he double-parked in front of the entrance to my building, he didn't turn off the engine. I was meant to step out, which I did. "See you in a bit," I said, to which he gave that silent, wistful nod of his, and then I simply found the courage. "I don't need to go home. I don't want to go home." "Get back in," he said. "I adore you, Helio. I adore you." We went straight to his home. We made love, even dozed a bit. Then quickly rushed to the concert, followed by the intermission cider, and then the three-course meal during which he held my hand. "Tomorrow is Monday," he said. Last week's Monday was agony. "Why?" I asked. But I knew the answer. "Because I felt I'd lost you." "And for what reason?" "Because I was scared you'd say no, and was trying not to seem depraved." He looked at me for a while. "Do you have to go home tonight? Do you want me to?" "We'll pretend we met tonight. And that instead of walking away with your bike, you said, 'I want to sleep with you, Michelle.' Would you have said it?" "I was on the verge of saying it, but no, you, sir, had to walk away." Monday morning, I decided to take a taxi and went straight home to change. The place looked slightly unfamiliar, as though I hadn't been there for weeks, months. The last time I'd seen morning there was on Saturday when I dashed upstairs, picked up a few things to wear, and rushed down to where he was waiting in his car. That afternoon, after teaching, I headed straight to the conservatory office to find whatever I could about Leon. When I saw Michel at our usual bistro that night, I told him that the trail had gone cold. Not a trace of Leon anywhere. He was more disappointed than I'd expected, which was why I had another idea on Tuesday. I tried two music schools and searched their yearly records, but once again, nothing. We both made the reasonable assumption that either Leon had studied abroad or that, like well-off Jews in the early years of the century, he had studied with a private tutor. Two more days went by this way. I had run out of clues. On Friday, however, I finally discovered Leon's identity in the record of the lycée where both Michel and his father had been enrolled and where the secretary had searched through the records in my presence after I'd claimed to be Michel's nephew. In the car to the country that day, I couldn't hold back and broke the news to him. I was even able to obtain his old address. The family name is Deschamps. The only problem is that Deschamps is not exactly a Jewish name. Could be an acquired or changed name. Think of Feldman, Feldenstein, Feldenblum, or just Feld. Could be, but there are many Leon Deschamps's on the web, assuming they are all alive or still live in France. The search could take months. He looked perplexed. What I couldn't help thinking was why he hadn't made the school connection himself. Finally, I asked him why, after all those years, he was still searching for Leon. It may tell me something about my father that I never knew. I'm also curious to know when and how Leon disappeared. But why? I don't know why. Maybe it's just a way of reaching my father, to know what made him stop doing what he loved most, and to understand his friendship or love for Leon, if love and friendship it was. It's the one thing my father never mentioned, and yet by the time I was 18, he could easily have opened up to me. Or perhaps I was not unlike my own son, and was trying to put some distance between us. Or maybe it was my way of atoning for not making time to know the man who'd stopped playing music. But how many of us ever make time to know who our parents really were? How many sunken layers deep are those we thought we knew simply because we loved them? In any event, I said, interrupting him, I've even found Leon's picture in the yearly class photo. Here, take a look. I produced the photo I'd had copied that same day in the school office. He is very handsome and looks very Catholic, very conservative. Indeed, very handsome, said Michel. Are you thinking what I'm thinking? I asked. Of course I'm thinking what you're thinking. It's what we've been thinking all along, isn't it? When we arrived, the first thing he did after depositing his bag and greeting the cook was to head directly to the living room, open a slim drawer in a little table by the French windows, and produce a large envelope. Take a look, he said. It was a blown-up old class photograph taken a year or two before the one I'd had reproduced. He pointed at Adrian with his pinky. He looked younger in this picture. We were both looking for Leon. Find him? He asked. I shook my head. But then, there he was, standing right next to Adrian. The resemblance between the face in my photograph and in the old class photograph was stunning. So you knew all along, I said. He nodded with a guiltily amused smile. I knew about the picture, but I needed someone else to confirm it. I thought about this for a while. Is that why you brought me here last week?
I knew you were going to ask this. The answer is no. There was another reason, and I'm sure you've guessed it. I want to give you the score. By giving it to you and to no one else, I am fulfilling my father's last wish. All I ask is that you play it at a concert.